On Setting Out and Coming Home by Joshua Mason Pollock, Minister, Unitarian Universalist Society, East Manchester, Connecticut. Read by Joshua Mason Pollock.
Reading number 655 in our hymnal, Singing the Living Tradition, is entitled Change Alone is Unchanging. It's attributed to the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus, also known as the Weeping Philosopher. In searching for truth, he says, be ready for the unexpected. Change alone is unchanging. These words ring true for me, the same truth I encounter in Reverend Vanessa Rush Southern's meditation, Expect Chaos, from her book, This Piece of Eden. She says, perhaps change is life. Frustrations and snags are life. Maybe instead of being taught to expect stability and predictability, we should have been taught to expect chaos, or at least constant transitions. Change alone is unchanging. As long as I'm alive and conscious of my living, I can expect to experience change. Certainly there will be changes in the wider world around me. Nations and governments change. Cultures and social norms change, human knowledge and technology change, ecology and climate change. The seasons and the positions of the stars in the night sky change. Certainly there will be changes in the more immediate patterns of my life. My children will grow older and my role in their life will change. My parents will grow older and my role in their lives will change. My wife will grow older. I will grow older. I can reasonably expect changes in my work life. I can reasonably expect changes in where I live. People will come in and out of my life, friends, parishioners, colleagues, peers, activists. I can expect the changes retirement brings. I can expect the changes illness brings. I can expect the changes loss brings and the changes that will come when loved ones die. And as a result of all these changes and transitions, I can also expect my inner life to change in response. What I believe, what matters to me, the things to which I feel called to dedicate time and energy, my understanding of the sacred, all of it has already changed through the course of my life. I can only conclude more change lies ahead. Change alone is unchanging. I suspect this is not news to you. At some place deep in our bones, we sense this idea is true. It speaks directly to Unitarian Universalists' common yearning for a religious life not bound by doctrines, creeds, and revelations presented to us as the one eternal truth, as the final word revealed once long ago and sealed forever. We long for spiritual openness. We are comfortable even with spiritual open-endedness. We long for a spiritual community that asks us not to submit to one truth, but rather to explore truth from many perspectives and construct meaning from many sources. We long for a faith informed as much by scientific discovery and changes in human knowledge as it is by ancient wisdom. We certainly don't long for chaos, and we want our children to experience stability and predictability, but when we encounter this idea that change alone is unchanging, something may stir in us. Often our gut response is, yes. We want to hear more because we experience our lives, all life, the earth, the universe, not as static, but as dynamic. Change is life. But let's be honest. As a concept, as a starting place for deeper theological reflection, okay, this idea is fabulous. Change alone is unchanging, yes. But as a practical matter, when it comes to dealing with day-to-day life, it's not so great. It doesn't matter what height of spiritual discipline you've achieved, the unexpected can really mess up your day. Even Jesus lost it from time to time. For human beings, and I'm sure for other creatures as well, change is hard. As spiritually and intellectually exhilarating as the idea of change is, the physical and emotional experience can be a real drag. I wouldn't be surprised if this is why the ancient Greeks referred to Heraclitus as the weeping philosopher. I think back to the summer of 1999 when my wife and I first moved to Connecticut. Over the previous 10 years, I had grown deeply accustomed to my life in Boston. I was grounded in the student culture in Cambridge. I was grounded in the local rock music scene. I was grounded in my ties to the Unitarian Universalist Association, which is headquartered in Boston. My twin brother and some of my best friends lived there. I was embedded in a rich network of peers, clergy, Unitarian Universalists, musicians, activists, and ultimate frisbee players. I knew all the running routes along the Charles River. I knew my way around by car and public transportation. My life had a certain stability and predictability to it. We moved to Connecticut that summer, and I became ill. I was chronically dizzy and nauseated. I lacked appetite. I lost weight. I drank ginger tea all the time, hoping it would settle my stomach. Nothing like this had ever happened to me before. It took many medical tests to prove to me there was nothing physically wrong with me, and 2 or 3 years of therapy to convince me that what had caused these symptoms was anxiety brought on by a major life transition. As much as I was genuinely excited to begin my professional career in a new location with new people, when I allowed myself to look closely at the life I had left behind in Boston and get in touch with what leaving meant to me, I realized I was sad. I was grieving my younger Boston self and really didn't know who my new professional minister self was. Move to a suburb? What? Buy a house? What? Have children? What? I'm not suggesting my experience of a big life transition is somehow a universal experience, but I do suspect that at the heart of our major life transitions, there is always some amount of grief, some sadness at the loss of what came before, and it stays with us. A book called A General Theory of Love, published in 2000 by the psychiatrists Thomas Lewis Fariamini and Richard Lannan, describes the way our relationships, particularly our very close, intimate relationships, shape us. Not only our emotions and our outlook on life, but also our body chemistry, our physiology, the development of our neural pathways. When two people live together in a long-term intimate relationship, when they share meals, leisure time, vacations, chores, money, a bed, child rearing, etc., over time their bodies become deeply intertwined. Here's a quote from the book. The human body constantly fine-tunes many thousands of physiological parameters: heart rate and blood pressure, body temperature, immune function, oxygen saturation, levels of sugars, hormones, salts, metabolites. But an individual does not direct all of his own functions. An intimate partner transmits regulatory information that can alter hormone levels, cardiovascular function, sleep rhythms, immune functions, and more. The reciprocal process occurs simultaneously. The first person regulates the physiology of the second, even as he himself is regulated. This is why living when a loved one has died isn't just emotionally painful, it physically hurts. This other body that has been regulating aspects of our physiology, this other body to which we have become habituated, is no longer present, no longer close by. I assume it's not just intimate loved ones who regulate our bodies in this way, although they may have the most impact. I assume where we live, the place we call home, our neighborhood, regulates our bodies to some degree. Where we work regulates our bodies to some degree. Our daily routine regulates our bodies to some degree. We become habituated in all sorts of ways. We become grounded in all sorts of ways. Thus, any transition, any change that requires us to break out of our habits will bring some pain, even if it's a change we want. I was ready to leave Boston in 1999. It was the right time for a life transition. But I see it so clearly now. Despite how right it seemed, my body was still wired for its patterns of life in Boston. And because I didn't know I was grieving that life, I became ill. I assume something like this happens with any life transition. A new school means different teachers, different peers, a different pattern to the day. The old ways have to shift. You or your partner receive a life-threatening diagnosis, and in the blink of an eye, all routine becomes geared towards treatment. Life's daily familiarities and pleasures become elusive, such that even food tastes differently. You lose a job, especially one that really matched your identity and sense of calling, and you must break with the habits of that job. You have a baby, and you must break with old habits. You retire, and you must break with old habits. Aging at any time in our lives, but certainly as our bodies and our minds begin to decline, requires that we break with old habits. Or consider becoming sober. For addicts, the body is utterly enmeshed with a substance, completely regulated by the need to have that substance. Getting sober is a grief-ridden process. Change alone is unchanging, said the weeping philosopher, but it's also really, really hard. Even if we've moved on in our minds, our bodies long for the way life was. In the midst of the grief that comes with life transitions, we have spiritual resources available to us. Perhaps most importantly, we have our own capacity for quieting down, becoming still, being peaceful, paying attention, breathing. When I open worship, I ask my congregants to find that place inside of you, that place where you may go when you long for comfort and solace, that place where you may go when you yearn for peace. We don't typically go there when confronted with a major life transition. We don't typically go there when the going gets tough and when we're in pain, when we've lost our job, when we've just received the diagnosis, when the funeral director is talking to us about arrangements for a deceased loved one. We're just as likely to be screaming or panicking, passing out or curled up on the floor in the fetal position. It takes real discipline to find a place of strength and grounding inside when your sources of strength and grounding outside have just disappeared. In moments of life transition, we need to stop and grieve for the life that is, for better or for worse, slipping away. We need times of quiet and stillness to say, think and feel whatever it is we need to say, think and feel about our old life before we can fully embrace the new. We need times of peacefulness and paying attention in order to break well with old habits. In her book, Drinking a Love Story, the late Carolyn Knapp writes about her experience of finding that place of quiet in community, in AA meetings. When people talk about their deepest pain, she says, a stillness often falls over the room, a hush so deep and so deeply shared it feels like reverence. That stillness keeps me coming, and it helps keep me sober, reminding me what it means to be alive, what it means to be human. Perhaps we can expect tears, because in those silent, still places where we find comfort and solace, and even joy, there we can grieve, and in grieving well, we can make ourselves ready for whatever new life awaits.